Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
These discussions with paramilitaries were at play with death.
Remarkable personal stories from around the world.
They don't speak with words, they speak with guns.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we're discussing whether or not coup plotter François Bozizé, exiled former president of the Central African Republic, will return to Bangui to stand trial for war crimes.
We have never seen such things happen in our country. We don't see a president of a country, which will be the president of Guinea-Bissau, handing over a former president, which will be President Bozizé, to the authorities of Central African Republic to be judged. No, it won't happen.
Why are some Ugandan cocoa farmers protecting their crops with armed gunmen?
You know, cocoa here is food. It is food and faster cash. When people don't have food, expect them to steal from those who have, because they know once you have some cocoa, you have money and therefore you have food. That is the only challenge that we have.
Also,
for outstanding environmental achievement for Africa, the 2024 Goldman Environmental Prize is awarded to Nonsle Boutuma and Sinagugu Zukulu, Wild Coast, South Africa.
Sinagugu and Nobuhle explain the fight that won them that prize. It's Thursday, the 2nd of May. First, we go to the Central African Republic. François Bozizé is a name many of you may not remember. I wouldn't blame you if you didn't, but I wouldn't be surprised if you did, because he was the president of the Central African Republic from 2003 to 2013, but he's been on the political scene for much longer. And you can't tell his story without mentioning the word coup. He came to power in a coup. He was deposed by a coup. He took part in two before that and one since. Now, there's an international warrant out for his arrest. It's the second arrest warrant against him. They were both issued by a special criminal court, which was set up in 2015, to look at war crimes committed since 2003. François Bozizé currently lives in exile in Guinea-Bissau. So, will he ever return to the Central African Republic to stand trial? Christian Gazambetti is the founder of CentraAfrica.com. We began our conversation with details of the charges against the former president.
They have made the inquiries and the investigations, and they have stated like a couple of precise moments, which happens between like 2009 and 2013, the death of several people and kidnappings and torture on several people. And with all those evidence that they had, that's when like they issued that international arrest warrant in February of this year.
So has the former president responded to these allegations?
Not to my knowledge. He has not responded to it yet, but I guess he will do it. But he's used to. He's used to have like international arrest warrant against him. So it's not something that will like, you know, cause him any fear, because I think that's the second one against him. Yeah, that's the second one to date, because in 2013, the Justice of Central African Republic already issued an international arrest warrant against him. And he came back in 2019, he came back to Central African Republic. The authorities didn't execute that warrant against him. So now that's the second international warrant against him. So he's used to.
Does he still wield quite a lot of power inside the Central African Republic? Because right now he's in exile in Guinea-Bissau, right?
Yeah, he's in Guinea-Bissau, yeah. It's not that he still wields a lot of power. He's not as quite popular that he was. The thing is, the mandate was not executed against him because the actual president, President Ouattara, was his former prime minister. So let's say they just choose to arrange it politically. He came back. They didn't arrest him. There was a deal. He was supposed to stay like quiet and to take advantage, take profit of the status of former president, but he was not supposed to get involved into political activities whatsoever. But he didn't respect the deal and he went to go to political activities, then into rebellion. So that's when the Justice of Central Africa condemned him to life in jail. but he was already away. And then you have now this what went from the special court.
So he's in Guinea-Bissau as a fugitive from justice. He's meant to be serving a life sentence. Is that how he ended up there?
He ended up in Guinea-Bissau because you have Angola that was doing mediation between the Central African president and all those warlords, those rebels leaders, among them Bozize. The deal was for all those leaders to be sent away from Central African Republic borders. And Bozize was in charge at that time. So when they made the deal happen, the president of Guinea-Bissau accepted to host him in Guinea-Bissau. But it was while he was in Guinea-Bissau that he was judged in Central African Republic for rebellion, and that's when they condemned him to life in jail. So the condemnation to life in jail was not what made him flee to Guinea-Bissau. It was a deal for the rebellion that they had conducted in 2021.
So is there any chance of this second arrest warrant being executed and him being repatriated to the Central African Republic from Guinea-Bissau?
Let's say the only chance to see that thing happen, to see that this mandate being executed, will be to the Guinea-Bissau authorities to accept to do it, because it's with them. They are hosting him now. So if they accept to cooperate, they're supposed to get him and deliver him to Central African Republic. But I don't see it happening.
And is your skepticism shared by people in the Central African Republic?
98% of the people think the same thing.
98%?
I would say 98%.
Right.
98% think the same thing, because we have never seen such things happen in our country. And then we don't see a president of a country, which will be the president of Guinea-Bissau, handing over a former president, which will be President Bozize, to the authorities of Central African Republic to be judged. No, it won't happen. And actually, the warrant was issued by, not by the government, it was issued by the special court. So like, that's like, I don't see it happening.
Well, talking of the special court, how effective have they been so far? Do people believe that they could get justice for people that had been the victims, or are people cynical about the special court in general as well?
Most of the people don't really understand like what the special court is doing in Central African Republic, because like they're not really being exposed to the right communication about the special court activities. But like for the people who know, we know that their job is not easy. Why? Because like they can deliver, but for them to deliver, to be effective, the collaboration with authorities has to be effective also. Let's say I give you an example. Like the special court might go after someone, have all the proof that this person committed crimes against humanity, but this person is in the government and it happened already before. That person can be a minister now because he was a rebel, and then there was a deal made with the government. Then they signed a deal. He came in the government. His people put down their weapons, and now he's a minister, but still he has committed crimes. And when the special court will go after that person, if the current authorities doesn't allow him to be delivered, nothing will happen. So when it's like that, you cannot do much. And it's not only one person. We have few of them like this, who are being like in a position of power in the country.
So everybody's got muddy hands and nobody can point a finger at the other. So why do you think the special court issued this arrest warrant? What's the point of it if everybody knows that the court doesn't really have the power to do it? Because, I mean, it doesn't serve the court to do something like this and then it doesn't happen, because it weakens it even more and people would regard it with even more skepticism.
Yeah, like the case of Bozize is quite sensitive, because the special court already put their hands on few people, and it happened. Like they issued some arrest warrant, they got the people, and the people are now in jail in Bangui. And some of the people are linked to Bozize, linked to the area like 2003 to 2013. And some of them like are also accused of committing those crimes. Some of them are in jail now, arrested by the special court. But they don't have the same weight than Bozize. So Bozize's case is sensitive. So for me, if they came out with this arrest warrant now, what has shifted is that pressure is needed on Bozize. I believe the Central African authorities wants to put more pressure on Bozize since he was convicted like to life in jail. And then he reacted to this conviction. He said that he would still continue the fight to liberate the people of Central African Republic, that it's not because he's into exile in Guinea-Bissau that he has left the fight. He will still fight. And him and his family members, because he's not the only one that were convicted and who has an international arrest warrant against him. He has a couple of his sons too and a couple of his people of his surroundings. But I don't really see them like bringing him back and trying to judge him in Central Africa. It will add too much turmoil in the country. I think they know that. It will bring more oil on the fire. The fire is still burning a little bit. So I don't see the authorities of Central African Republic trying to put more oil on the fire.
Okay. Fantastic. Christian, thank you so much. That's been really, really interesting.
You are welcome.
Christian Gazambetti from CentrAfrica.com. Let's talk about cocoa. The main ingredient for making chocolate in Uganda, some cocoa farmers are hiring armed men to protect their crops. The reason for this is that cocoa is in very high demand right now, but supplies are down because of poor production by the main producers in West Africa, Ivory Coast, Ghana, and Nigeria principally. Prices are going up and Ugandan farmers are reaping the benefit of that, even though their production is not extensive. At the moment, cocoa is grown for export in just one district, which neighbors the Democratic Republic of Congo. So what are the prospects for cocoa farmers in Uganda? Who better to talk to us about this than Musa Mutalinga, a cocoa farmer and the export coordinator of the Uganda Cocoa Association. I'm going to start by asking, you know, I didn't know that Uganda was a big producer of cocoa. Is it?
We are not as big as Ivory Coast and Ghana. However, we are trying to improve on our production.
Right. So how long have you been a cocoa farmer?
I grew up seeing cocoa in my home village, and I started acquiring cocoa in the last 20 years.
And in the organization, the Uganda Cocoa Association, you are exports coordinator. So give me an idea of how much you export and where you export to.
We do around 300,000 metric tons. That is per crop season.
And where does it go?
We sell in Europe, majorly in Europe, and of recent, Asia has come on board. But we have been selling in Europe.
So has your share of the export market been growing in relation yes. to previous years? Give us an idea of how much more you're selling now.
Last year, we did around 400,000 metric tons. However, production has gone down because of the weather changes, climate changes, and it is coming down to around 350 metric tons this year.
And that is just because of the climate?
Yes, the productivity has gone down.
What about cocoa production in other parts of the continent, West Africa? Has it been affected as well? Is production coming down there as well?
That is right. That is right. The only area that is going up, is growing up in production, is the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo.
Oh, why is that?
For them, they utilize in the equatorial rainforest. So the amount of rains in that area is high as compared to the Ugandan side. And two, they have a lot of land. There is a lot of free land. Land acreage is enough.
I thought that the area is not very secure because we always hear about, you know, the militias and so on.
That is true. A few areas that have some security are doing good production. However, most areas are affected with insecurity, but still, cocoa still comes up to this other side of Uganda.
Speaking of security, it's an issue for you as well, right? We are hearing that farmers are, you know, protecting their cocoa farms with armed men.
That is true. You know, cocoa here is food.
You say it's food.
It is food and faster cash. So what do I mean? When farmers sell cocoa, they buy food. When people don't have food, expect them to steal from those who have. The security of cocoa is within. The local people steal amongst themselves because they know once you have some cocoa, you have money and therefore you have food. That is the only challenge that we have.
So it seems like it's significant enough for you to bring in an armed guard.
Basically, there are few of those farmers who have the capacity of bringing in the armed guards. But locally, we organize our own youth and take care of our gardens without even arms.
So what's happening with the price of cocoa at the moment? Is it very high?
It is. It has gone very high. You can imagine cocoa from the last 6 months, it was around $3 to $2. But now it is going to $8 to $9 a kilo.
Wow. So it's sort of doubling and tripling in price. Why?
We understand there is a problem with the production in Ivory Coast and Ghana and maybe Nigeria. The production has gone down and therefore every buyer is looking at one spot, that is Uganda. So Ugandan cocoa is of good quality and good taste. It has a good taste of chocolate. So everybody is probably to come and buy from Uganda.
So, you know, I'm something of a chocolate connoisseur, simply because I really do like good quality chocolate. So tell me, what sorts of flavors you get in a Ugandan chocolate? Is it very dark and very dense, or is it light?
It is dark and dense.
Do you like chocolate? Do you make chocolate? Do you eat chocolate?
We don't make chocolate here. We have not yet progressed to manufacturing. But I like chocolate. So we also import chocolate after selling the beans.
Uh-huh. So cocoa farmers in Uganda are getting quite wealthy, are they?
Yes, the farmers are doing very well, though they haven't got government support to teach them how to use the money. You know, Africans, we need to come down and educate our people how to use that windfall that has come in unexpectedly. So they are somehow not using the money well. But at least their children are going to school and they are putting up some good permanent houses. So you can see the impact of the prices.
And do you think that your share will increase given that there are problems in West Africa?
Our shares will not increase because the production will remain the same. The land has not expanded. The land remains the same. We are trying to introduce cocoa to other parts of the country, which is not doing very well.
I see. Okay, I was going to ask you, if you want to produce more effectively, what help do cocoa farmers need in order to expand their productions?
In the past few years, government was distributing free seedlings to cocoa farmers all over the country. But we realized that people were concentrating much on cocoa than food. So the land, people were fighting for the last space between cocoa planting and food. So we realized we are going to be having a crisis of food if we concentrate too much of cocoa. Now we are limiting farmers to plant a certain limited number of acreage for cocoa and reserve some land for food.
So let's just return to the issue of security. You said that it's an internal thing, it's an inside job with people stealing amongst each other. But I'm just wondering, if the price is going up and it becomes more valuable, can you see a scenario in which people will now actually start stealing larger quantities and try to sell it, you know, on the market themselves?
Yes, we expect that. And we are engaging the community to be vigilant so that they can be able to secure their farms.
And by that, you mean they'll be bringing in young men that you said that are organizing at local levels. But will you arm them as well?
With the time, it will require arming them. Look at a scenario where cocoa is stolen within a container going to Nairobi through going to Mombasa, and some armed people hijack it along the road. So it becomes a big security issue where you need armed people to transport the merchandise to Mombasa.
It's a bit worrying, isn't it?
It is.
Could you see a situation where you'll get sort of police escort or army escort rather than having arms in the hands of people, you know, young men, and you never know where those arms will go?
The biggest challenge in Africa, particularly in Uganda, is you may not have enough policemen to do their other work and then later on come and guard your farms or even escort your produce to the market. It may not be possible. However, the spotters, because they are big, they can do that. They are doing that from Kampala to Mombasa. They're escorting their containers to the sea. That one is being done. Last year, we had a scenario where one of the exporters lost a 20-foot container of cocoa along the road from Kampala to Mombasa.
No, that must have been a big blow to that person.
That was. You see, when there is a problem, you keep looking for solutions. I am sure as the problem escalates, we shall have a solution for that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Mbusa Mutalinga, cocoa farmer and export coordinator for the Uganda Cocoa Association. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Lives Less Ordinary brings you remarkable personal stories from across the globe, from people who've chased their dreams.
No one knew that I was going to travel by bike. If I had told them that I was riding a bike to Egypt, they might have said that it was impossible.
To people who've lived through nightmares.
Being in jail in Thailand, I made a promise to myself in that jail that when I'm home, I'm going to volunteer somewhere.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now to one of those David and Goliath battles, a small community fighting a huge multinational in this case. Back in September 2022, community campaigners and indigenous peoples on South Africa's Wild Coast, which is situated in the Eastern Cape, forced the oil giant Shell to stop exploration along their coastline. Sinegugu, Zukulu, and Nontle Mbutuma represent the David bit of this analogy, and they were jointly awarded the Goldman Environmental Prize, which is described as the equivalent of the Oscars. Sinegugu and Nontle are from the Mpondo community in Mpondoland, and according to their beliefs, their ancestors live in the sea and portals along the Wild Coast, which allows Mpondo healers and elders to communicate with their ancestors. Their work and achievement has brought legal recognition of the cultural and spiritual rights of South Africa's indigenous communities who need to protect their marine environments. This is the first time a successful environmental challenge was made based on ties to customary cultural, spiritual, and economic rights. Let's listen to the moment they were declared the winners of the Goldman Environmental Prize.
For outstanding environmental achievement for Africa, the 2024 Goldman Environmental Prize is awarded to Nonsle Mbutuma and Sinegugu Zukulu, Wild Coast, South Africa.
Let me first say a warm thank you to the Goldman Environmental Foundation for this prize and the recognition of activists' work in service of our indigenous community.
Richard Kagwe spoke to Sinegugu and Nontle before they knew they had won.
Recently, you got the recognition by receiving the Environmental Prize for your campaign in organizing the local community there and stopping plans for oil and gas in an area known in South Africa as the Wild Coast. So just describe to me the area. Who are the people who live there? What's the environment like? And why is it so important to the people?
The area where I live on the Wild Coast, it's one of the unique biodiversity that you find here, which is very unique to the people that they live here. It's very important because since we defended our biodiversity for quite long time, 1950s, when we hear that Shell is planning to do the seismic survey in our ocean, and then we just realize that again, our biodiversity, our marine life, it will be disturbed because ocean for us is not just a place for taking tours or just to enjoy. It's a sacred place. It's a home to us because our ancestors are residing there. That is why it's so important for also for our livelihood.
So when you're talking about marine life, just describe to me, what are we seeing?
When I said marine life, we're talking about everything that is in the ocean. We're talking about water because water also, it's a life because it's part of our traditional medicine. We're talking about the fishes, crayfish, oysters, dolphin, whales, everything that is there. It's marine life and it's very important to us.
So Sinegugu, this story was in the news, especially when information, you know, got out that the multinational company Shell was planning to explore gas and oil in the area. Nontle has just alluded to that. Tell me exactly what was proposed and whether the local people there were consulted.
What was proposed was for Shell wanted to do a seismic survey in order to explore for the presence of oil and gas. The seismic survey is where you have got this ship which is dragging many air guns which are going to be shot or release waves, making these loud noises on the ocean every 10, as many as 40 air guns, and shooting or blasting every 10 seconds for 5 months. So we're talking about very loud noise, and the marine ocean, the marine life, which would be hugely impacted because we know that the marine animals, they communicate through sound. And the sound of blasting, which releases waves that go and hit the ocean floor, and then the sound is reflected back to the ship, and which helps the computers to detect whether there is oil and gas. We're talking about very loud, and also under the ocean, these sounds are much more louder. And what we found out talking to marine biologists who were able to write affidavits to join us in the court case, because of that, it does affect the base of the food chain, the ocean or marine ecosystem, which leads to a decline in the catch or in the fisheries that people are dependent on. We went to court because we realized that this is going to have a huge impact in our ocean in terms of the marine life. What was annoying us more than anything was the fact that government failed to consult us. And in terms of the constitution and the laws of South Africa, any development which is going to be done, any project, the law requires that people who are interested and who are going to be affected must be consulted. And also in terms of our laws, our customary laws, if you're going to give somebody a site amongst the people, our customary law requires that all the neighbors must be consulted. So government had issued a permit to Shell to do this seismic exploration without consulting the people. So we went there to court to say, it can't be right. It is wrong. It is illegal for government to not consult us.
And Nonle, just how strong was this opposition? So you've moved to court and the community feels that it is aggrieved and the government overlooked them. How did you go about mobilization?
In terms of mobilization, the short time was really stressing us because we hear when the government is already giving the permission to Shell that they must start a seismic survey. But we've done all our best to mobilize our communities, to inform our communities. And that mobilization, it was done the most mobilization around the world because it was being supported by the coastal communities and also the inland communities, which is something that it's not usual in South Africa where there is a struggle that it brings the whole South Africa together. And also, it was not only the protest only in South Africa and also abroad. And when we mobilized, we didn't mobilize only the protest, also to mobilize the affidavits to make sure that when we argue in court, there are people that they are committed that this project of Shell, of oil and gas, is not good for our communities. And it was not even difficult to collect those affidavits because people, they said that they are really committed to defend the future of our communities. Because when you put oil and gas in our ocean, it means that you kill our future.
When was exploration supposed to happen?
The exploration was supposed to happen during December. It was like a very short time for us because December is a very busy month, but we're just busy organizing ourselves because the vessels were already in our ocean. The time when we mobilized, it was quite difficult. We were also being told that we cannot defeat Shell because Shell is the biggest company that is going to organize the top class lawyers. Now we are a community. We cannot fight with Shell. We know that even if they do have quite a lot of money, but that money, it's not bigger than our future.
Do you think that has inspired other grassroots activism in South Africa and outside of South Africa?
That campaign, it shows a precedent to all the other communities that if communities come together and speak in one voice, they can succeed, they can win what they want. The more the organized communities, the more the communities they win. Because these corporations, they are happy to see the unorganized communities. But the more we organize, the more we mobilize ourselves, the more we defend our environment.
And Sinegugu, talking about the environmental prize, you got this recognition. What does this really mean to you?
The award is a very humbling and is very much appreciated to us because it recognizes the efforts that we've made over many years. This was not the first struggle that we have waged in terms of protecting the environment, the biodiversity. There's also been over two decades of fighting against and imposed mining in our area. So to be finally recognized at a global scale for the sacrifices and the dedication we've done, it's very humbling and it's very much appreciated because what it means, the work that we have been doing for so many years is not in vain. It also means a lot in terms of to motivate the young people in our communities, but it also means the other indigenous people in other parts of the world that this fighting to protect the environment, fighting to protect the planet is a worthy cause.
This award, honestly, I was not expecting, because when you environmentalist, you always been painted as somebody that you against the development. You painted as somebody that you protecting the butterflies. Now we need more butterflies as we needed before. And the environmentalist is not defending just butterflies. It's defending the Mother Earth, which is all of us that we need to stand up and defend. To being recognized, it gives a big honor to us and to the community in large. The fight that they are fighting is not the fight for our community, but it's the fight for the future. It's the fight for the planet that all of us that we need to live long.
Thank you so much to you both. Really appreciate your time, Sinegugu and Nanohle. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Richard.
Wild Coast Warriors or environmental grassroots activists, winners nonetheless, Sinegugu Zukulu and Nontle Mbutuma in South Africa. Focus on Africa was put together by Charles Kitonga in Nairobi. Rob Wilson and Paul Bajibinga were on it from London. Carney Sharp was the senior journalist. Nick Randall was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
Lives Less Ordinary brings you remarkable personal stories from across the globe, from people who've chased their dreams.
No one knew that I was going to travel by bike. If I had told them that I was riding a bike to Egypt, they might have said that it was impossible.
To people who've lived through nightmares.
Being in jail in Thailand, I made a promise to myself in that jail that when I'm home, I'm going to volunteer somewhere.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.